Sorry. I don't really want this chair, but they've put it here anyway, so. Yeah, but they told me the computer wasn't any good, so. At least you can sit at it.
The computer's not any good?
Okay. Oh, some kind of little bug. All right. Ah. All right. Let's settle down and get started this morning. Last time we talked about, we began talking about the quantum circuit model for quantum computing, and we talked about 1 and 2 qubit. Unitary gates. And the 2-qubit unitary gates we talked about were mostly just the controlled NOT gate. And the controlled NOT gate is a, okay, good. Bravo. The controlled NOT gate was a surprise. Because unlike the classical controlled NOT operation on a pair of bits, in which the control operates on the target but is not itself affected at all. There's a one-way flow of information in the controlled knot classically. We found that the controlled knot, the quantum mechanical controlled knot, the unitary controlled knot gate, is quite different. In fact, if you adopt if you put Hadamard gates before and after the controlled knot, then that basically is doing the controlled knot, but thinking about it in the conjugate basis. That turns out to be the controlled knot, but going the opposite direction. In other words, there's really no distinction between the control bit and the target bit, no fundamental distinction. It's not like information is really only going from the control bit to the target bit. With some initial states, like the computational basis states, yeah, the final state of the target can change, but the final state of the control doesn't. But if you look at other states, like the conjugate basis states, then something quite different happens. And if you look at still other states, then this gate can produce entanglement. So what I want to do is I want to actually take a moment and interrupt our discussion of this and sort of tell you about, prove to you, a general fact about unitary interactions between systems. And it's a handy general fact to know. It's one of those fundamental facts that's not hard to prove but is really useful. And so here we go. This is our general fact. We're going to consider two systems. And we're going to call them C and T, just to remind ourselves of the control and target guys. So we've got system CT, okay, and with some unitary interaction, and we're going to call that U. That's a unitary interaction between the two. And we're going to suppose that for any initial product state, so a psi of C and a phi of T, I'll write it this way, that if I take the state that I get by acting on this with U, so these guys now interact with each other, this is the final state of the system, and I take the trace over the target, the partial trace over the target, I'll get a state, I'll get a C state that is independent of the initial target state. Okay? Now this condition is a little bit like the condition for informational isolation, but it's somewhat stronger because for informational isolation, we assumed that the environment system started out in some fixed standard state. But now we're making a stronger statement. We're saying that no matter what the initial state of C, which is playing the role of the environment from before, no matter what the evolution of the initial state of C, then the final state of C is independent of the initial state of T. And this is what we would mean by no information flow. No information flow from T to C. That's what we would mean. For there to be no information flow. That means no matter how these things start out, the final state of the C system, the control system, is independent of the initial state of the target system. And what I want to show you, is that if there's no information flow this way, there's also no information flow the other way. Okay? That's what I'm going to show you. That the condition that no information can go from T to C in the evolution also excludes the possibility that information can go from C to T. So this thing we found out about the C naught, that there's no one-way information flow, is actually a general property of quantum interactions. And that's really handy. That's a really nice thing to understand. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to fix. This is our condition. This is our condition. We're imagining that this is true, and so now let's fix some initial state for the control bit, and we'll call that initial state C sub zero. Okay. And so with a fixed initial state for these guys. The hypothesis now reads, given that fixed initial state, this evolves to a state such that the final state of C is independent of the initial state of T, which means that this, given for this initial fixed state of the control, T is informationally isolated. Okay? That's what our hypothesis means. This is our hypothesis. So our hypothesis implies that T is informationally isolated for this initial state of C. And that means that the evolution of the initial state C naught phi can be written that the final state is a product state of C tensor V psi. That is to say, there's a unitary operator that tells me how this evolves, that tells me how T evolves, and there's some fixed final state for the control system. But let's think about this. What does this mean? What things in this might depend on the initial state of the control bit, the control system? I'm sorry, I'm not consuming the qubits. What things in this expression might depend on my choice, what this guy was? Well, in principle, both V and C might depend on it. Okay? So, things that might depend on C naught include V and also C. So we start with a different C naught, something else might happen. And that means that there might be a different final state for T, and that would mean that the initial state of the control system could affect the final state of the target system. So that's a possibility, still possible right at this point. Now, there's one other thing I want to mention here, and that is that when I construct these guys, V and C, there's a little bit of arbitrariness. If I change the phase of C by multiplying it by e to the I phi, I could compensate for that by multiplying the unitary operator by e to the minus I phi. I'm sorry, phi is a bad e to the I alpha. Okay, I could if I took C to e to the I alpha C and V to e to the minus I alpha V, it would be the same. Okay, that would be I'd get an expression just like this. And multiplying a unitary by a phase is just fine. That doesn't change this from being a unitary to being something else. So there's a little bit of arbitrariness here. And here's how I want you to deal with the arbitrariness in this case. Pick one. Pick a phase. Settle on it. But remember that there's this arbitrariness. Okay? So pick one. All right. Now I want you to pick another one. Pick another initial C state. So now pick another initial state for the control system. Pick another initial state for the control system. And let's make it not orthogonal to the original one, so that let's pick another one, but it's not just an orthogonal state of the control system. It's some other quantum state. Okay. Well. Our hypothesis applied to the fixed initial state C naught prime tells us that T is informationally isolated again. Okay? And that implies that U of C zero prime phi is equal to, once again, I'm going to be able to find a final state for the control system, playing the role of the environment here, and a unitary operator for the target system, so that the final state of this joint state is something like this. I've written these guys with primes because what they are might depend on which state I had picked for the control system initially. That's why these guys have primes. But remember, there's still this phase arbitrariness, right? There's still this phase arbitrariness. I could redefine these things and get something that's the same. Okay, something that would have the same form. Everybody good? Okay. So let's take the inner product of the two things that we had before, the original one and this one. Let's take the inner product. That is to say, let's take for a given target state, let's take the inner product of C0 phi. Let's see, this will I hate the seam here, U dagger, U C0 prime, phi, same phi. Okay. Let's take this inner product. Of course, that's just equal to the inner product of C0 with C0 prime, because the U dagger U is the identity, and phi inner product with itself is 1. But it's also equal to, according to our results, we've applied the information, or the isolation theorem, rather. We applied the isolation theorem a couple of times for two different initial C states. That also implies that this is C, C prime, phi, V dagger, V prime, phi. Now think about this. I've now got that this thing is equal to this thing. Let's look at this inner product right here. That's the only thing in this equation that is dependent on phi. It's the only thing in this equation that's dependent on phi. And this guy, oh sorry, this guy is not zero. This guy's not zero, so neither of these guys can be zero. So this is independent of phi. What kind of thing could it be? What could it be? Well, let's think about it. This thing in between here is unitary. So V dagger, V prime is unitary because both V and V prime are unitary. And V dagger is unitary, and products of unitary are unitary. Okay? Well, that means, for example, that V dagger, V prime has eigenstates, right? Unitaries have eigenstates. They're normal operators. Well, so nothing would prevent me from just picking phi to be one of those eigenstates, right? Because this is independent of what phi is, so I can just pick one, pick an eigenstate, and that means that what I get out of this would be the eigenvalue associated with that eigenstate. Oh, but what is that eigenvalue? It's a complex number with modulus 1. It's something like e to the I alpha. This must equal e to the I alpha for some alpha. Okay? So now I say, oh, I see what I did wrong. I should redefine my operators. I should, instead of having the V prime that I had before, I should multiply it by e to the minus I alpha, which is my V prime, my new V prime. Okay? That's my new V prime. It's equal to the e to the minus I alpha times the old V prime. And similarly, my C prime, which I had here. Remember, there's this phase ambiguity. Where do I put the phase? The phase of a state vector is a global property, and if it's a product vector, I can either put that phase on the state of the first system or the state of the second system or distributed among them. You can't tell. It's a global property of it, and so I can redefine this guy to be e to the I alpha times the old guy. That's my new guy. Okay? And under this redefinition, now this inner product is 1 for any phi. And using our favorite fact, if this is 1 for any normalized phi, this must be the identity. V dagger V prime is equal to the identity. And that, of course, means that V prime is the same as V. V prime is the same as V. And if V prime is the same as V, we also note that, V prime is the same as V. Very good. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. What I did was I took the inner product of this guy and this guy for the same phi. But I could do that for any phi. And this inner product on this side is independent of phi. And this is independent of phi. This is the only part that depends on what my choice of phi. Because this is independent of phi, in order to figure out what it is, I could imagine what it would be if phi was an eigenvector. But if it's this for phi being an eigenvector, it must be this for any phi, because this is the only part this has to be independent of phi, because everything else in the equation is independent of phi. Right. So that's the form of the argument. Okay. That's the logic. Yes. No. We said the isolation theorem is such that if T is informationally isolated, then there's a unitary operator that describes the evolution of phi. That operator does not depend itself on phi. It tells how phi changes. That was the result of our thing. So this doesn't depend on phi, but it might depend on C naught. But now I'm showing you that it doesn't depend on C naught. That if I pick any other state, I can, by adjusting the phases properly, make sure that the V I get from that state, that initial C state, is the same as the original V. So I picked a V for one of them, and then for anything that's not actually orthogonal to that, I also get a V, and it turns out to be the same V. And for using those, I can get to the things that are actually maybe orthogonal to the original one. The point is, all the V's are the same. They do not, at least I can choose them so that they do not depend on the initial state of the system. And so that means that has as a consequence that if I have U acting on some initial product state, that's equal to some final state of the control system, tensor V phi, and this is independent of C naught. This is independent of C naught. The only thing in this that can depend on the initial control state is this. This is the only thing that depends on the control state. This one doesn't depend on the initial control state. Because these various V's, I can fiddle with their phases and make them all the same. All the same as the first one that I picked up. Now, I could go on to show that this C is related to that C naught by a unitary operator. But I don't really need that. This is the only thing that depends on C naught. This by itself tells me that the final, that for any, this tells me that the final state of T is independent, this final state of T, which is this guy, is independent of the initial state of the control system. And that means that there's no information flow from C to T. There's no information flow from C to T. We might be fooled about this if we consider only basis states. In the C naught example, there's a unitary interaction between the two things. We consider only basis states, and it looks like the final state of the target depends on the initial state of the control, but not vice versa. That the control bit is simply not affected by the target. If you only look at basis states, you might be fooled. But in fact, there are some other states where the final state of the control is affected by the initial state of the final state of the control is affected by the initial state of the target. That's always true if the interaction of two systems permits, under some circumstances, information to flow one way, then it also permits information to flow the other way. There's no such thing as one-way information flow in an interaction between systems. Yeah?
So you're basically saying that the information isolation cannot act in one way. If there's information exchange, it has to be both ways?
Here's what it means. If, in terms of information isolation, if, imagine I had a system and its environment. Information isolation is about a situation where the environment state is fixed. But if the system is informationally isolated from the environment for all initial environment states, then the two systems are in fact independent dynamically. They don't interact at all. Okay? They don't interact at all. Informational isolation is about a situation in which the initial state of the environment is fixed. Environment being played by the control system here. The initial state is fixed, and then the isolation theorem tells you a condition for the condition on the evolution of the joint system. If the informational isolation condition holds for all initial environment states, then in fact the two systems are dynamically independent. Dynamically independent. Their interaction can be represented as a unitary for the environment, tensor a unitary for the system. That's really what this means. Okay. Well, I wanted to take the time to talk about this. This is a general principle of wide applicability. I imagine that you will think about this again sometime this year. You say, oh yeah, that's what that means. This is just that no one-way information flow fact. It's a good heuristic. And it's suggested by our quantum circuit model. But now I want to get rid of it. I want to talk about quantum circuits again and go on and do more sophisticated stuff and amaze you in some other way. Okay? All right. So I'm going to erase. That's what I'm really I'm putting it off so that some people can catch up with their note-taking. Okay. All right. So back to quantum circuits. There's a very important theorem, which I will state but not prove. But it is very important. And the important theorem is that the things we've been talking about are enough. What do I mean by that? Well, okay, important theorem. Important theorem comes in two parts. Let's see, I've had the wonderful theorem and the nice theorem. This is the important theorem. The first thing is that every u on n qubits, so any unitary on n qubits whatsoever, can be constructed from one qubit and 2-qubit gates. Every unitary on n qubits can be constructed out of 1-qubit and 2-qubit unitary gates. That's an amazing thing. It's not true for classical reversible gates. If you have a classical reversible function on n-bit input, you can't always make that function out of classical reversible gates on 1 and 2 bits that you put together. You need at least a 3-bit gate to make any of those. But quantum mechanically, you can make every unitary on n qubits out of 1-qubit and 2-qubit gates. That's a really useful fact, because that means that if I know how to make these things, if I know how to build these things in my quantum computer, I can use them as parts to assemble any one of these guys. Now I'm beginning to get at the heart of things, building a computation out of small steps. And here's the second one. This is very cool. Every 2-qubit gate can be constructed from one qubit gates and C naughts. The only 2-qubit gate that I really need is C naught. Everything else, if I just use 1-qubit gates, that's enough. I can build any 2-qubit gate out of that. And then once I can build any 2-qubit gate, I can build any unitary on n qubits. So what that means is if I have the set of 1-qubit gates, the set of all 1-qubit gates, and I union that with a set of all the C naughts between all the pairs of qubits, if I take that combination, I have what's called a universal set. A universal set. Of gates. It's a set of gates that is sufficient to construct any unitary operator on any number of qubits. Yeah. Oh, I see. The number of gates that might be required, number of 1 and 2-qubit gates, number of C naughts and single qubit gates that might be required to build a unitary operator, goes up rather rapidly, perhaps, with the number of qubits. And I don't know. I'm not sure that the infinite machine is quite well defined. But what I do know is that you might have to work dang hard to make just some unitary operation on 100 billion qubits. Okay, it might require a lot of gates, but finite number. In some sense, if these are the kinds of things you can actually do, this means that any unitary is computable. We can realize it in our quantum computer by something like this. It'll look like this. We have some unitary, and what does that mean? Well, I'm going to be able to build it out of things that look like this. You know, and maybe some. I'm just making something up. Don't get alarmed here. Right. Okay. Here we go. The story is that I'll be able to find some combination of single qubit unitaries and C naughts that'll build this guy. That'll build this guy. And so the problem of figuring out how to make your quantum computer work boils down to the problem of how to find the set of gates that does the operation you want it to do. So, by the way, there's nothing magical about CNAUT. There are lots of other single qubit unitary gates that would do the job as well. But CNAUT is just so simple that will generally take this to be our universal set that we'll adopt. We'll suppose we can make these guys, and if we can make these guys, we can make anything. Okay. So what we've got is we've got this particular operation which may do our computation as a sequence of elementary operations which involve only one or two qubits. So this amounts to our quantum computer program for doing this. Now, now that I've told you that you can do this, let me just introduce another handy object, which will be a handy type of object. And in fact, your homework problem will be to show how to build it out of one and two qubit gates. And it's not too bad. All right. And that's the Toffoli gate. Toffoli gate was originally devised for classical reversible computation. But we're going to consider the quantum mechanical version. And it basically works like this. It's what you might call the controlled, controlled knot. Okay? It's the controlled, controlled knot. And you write it like this. You've got two controls and one target. And informally, what happens is you negate the target only if both controls are one. Only if both controls are one. Well, let's see. How do we write that? How do we write that mathematically? Well, I can consider how it works on basis states. And if I tell you how this works on basis states, I've defined the whole evolution, right? I've defined how it works because everything's linear. So this takes, if I've got basis states A, B, C, so all these guys are either 0 or 1, and C, somewhat confusingly, represents the target state. Then this evolves to A, B, and now I want to know whether I should negate C or not. So I'm going to take C and I'm going to add to it the product of A, B. The product of A, B, this is product modulo 2, which is actually just product, 0 and 1. If you multiply any two binary digits together, you get 0, unless they're both 1. And this says you leave C alone for 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, but when you have 1, 1, you take C and you negate it. That's what this means. Okay? And so this is how the Toffoli gate works for arbitrary inputs. And it turns out that from the Toffoli gate, we can create other multiply controlled unitary gates. And we can build the Toffoli gate out of one and two qubit unitaries by our theorem. And how to do that is a little bit, you have to work a little bit hard. You have to actually think about it quantum mechanically. It's not enough just to think about basis states. That's one of the tasks of your homework. Let's suppose we could make a Toffoli gate given Toffoli. Let's make a doubly controlled U gate for some arbitrary U. But let's assume we have a controlled U gate. This is a kind of a cute trick, and so I want to show you how it works because it's got a technique that's useful in quantum computing problems. And the idea is this, that I have four qubits. involved. 4 qubits. Okay? There's C1, there's C2, the two control qubits. There's the target qubit, but there's also W. W is a work qubit. It's a work qubit, and it's initially set to 0. It's also going to be 0 at the end as well. It's just scratch space, but I erase it before at the end of my computation. And so here's my claim. If I have C1 and C2 and the work qubit, which is initially 0 and T, here they go. What do I do? Well, the first thing I do is I take the Toffoli gate with the two controls as the control, and I act on the work qubit. Now, what does that do? Well, the work qubit will switch from 0 to 1. If I just consider basis states, the work qubit will switch from 0 to 1 only if both the control qubits are 1. And that's exactly when I want to apply the unitary operator U on the target. And so I'll just use a controlled U gate controlled by the work qubit. But now this is not exactly what I want, because the work qubit may be correlated here. I want to set it back to 0. And I do that by just doing the Toffoli gate again. Okay, that works. That works. Let's see that it works. I sort of told you my intuition as I went along, but let me sort of show you how you might demonstrate that. And so let me consider initial states of the following form. The following form is A, B, C, tensor something. And this is for C1, C2, the work qubit, and the target qubit. All right? Yeah? And these guys are basis states, computational basis states, and this might be anything, I don't care. But every state can be written as a superposition of things like this. So this guy, A, B, C, tensor, phi, what happens at the first Toffoli gate? Well, what happens is I get, as I said over there, I get A, B, I get C plus, oh, sorry, C is initially 0. C is initially 0, isn't it? So I get AB, tensor phi. And now I apply the controlled U guy. And I'm going to write this way. What happens is I get AB, AB, tensor U, but it's all, U is applied only if AB is 1, right? So I'm going to write that as U to the AB power applied to phi. And see, when AB is 1, this is U, and when AB is 0, it's the identity. Okay? And then when I do this again, I get AB, AB plus AB, tensor U to the AB times phi, which is equal to, well, anything plus itself is 0. That's the law of binary arithmetic. And so I get AB 0 tensor U to the AB phi, which is exactly what I want. That's exactly what I want. This is U phi if these guys are ones, and it's just what I had before. if these guys are 0, 1, 1, 0, or 0, 0. Okay? Why did I do this? Well, this kind of reasoning will be useful to you in working problems. Okay. So I want to now jump up a level and sort of talk about how my computer works, my general computing scheme, and the sort of thing I might need to be doing in the computer. And then I want to show you an example where quantum computers are more powerful than classical computers, substantially more powerful. Okay, so here's our general scheme. Number one, initially, all qubits are in the state 0. What this means is that if we need some other state, if we need, for example, to have a state that represents some number or something, the first part of the program will have to be creating that state by a series of quantum gates. Okay? The first stage of the computation will have to be to create that state. And we can do that. We can do that. For example, suppose we had two qubits. And we want the Bell basis state phi plus, which is an entangled state of those two guys. How would I get that if I started out with zeros? Well, let me show you the circuit that actually prepares that. It's got my favorite gate, the Hadamard, and it's got a C-naught, and that's it. Well, let's see how that works. These both start out to be zero, right? So I've got 0, 0 to start out with. And then the Hadamard acts on the first one. And the Hadamard takes 0 to 0 plus 1 over the square root of 2. So 1 over the square root of 2 times 0, 0 plus 1, 0. Right? That's what happens. That's what that first gate does. Now, what does the C-naught do? Well, the C-naught switches one of the value of the target qubit, the second one, depending on the value of the first one. That's in the computational basis. So let's see, 0, 0 will map to 0, 0. But what does 1, 0 map to? That's the control. That's the target. 1, 1. Oh, and that's just the state I wanted. So the point here is that I can, even if I start out with all the qubits being zero, I can create any state that I need in the first stage of my computation. Okay? Right. Second point in the general scheme. At the end, we can measure, we measure the qubits in the 0, 1 basis. Well, what if we need to measure something else? What if we need to measure the conjugate basis instead? Well, let's see. The measurement is denoted by a box with a little dial. That's the dial reading tells you what you got. And this measures the 0, 1 basis. Suppose I wanted to measure some other basis at the end. Suppose I wanted to measure the conjugate basis, the plus minus basis. How would I do it? Is the answer too obvious or not obvious enough? Exactly. The first thing I do is I feed it to a Hadamard, and then I make a measurement. The same measurement as before. But then this entire box, what does it do? Well, if I feed in plus, the Hadamard turns it to zero, and I get zero. If I feed in minus, the Hadamard turns it to one, and I get one. So what this whole thing does, this whole thing measures the plus minus basis. Okay? So the point is that by suitably manipulating the state ahead of time, my basis measurement can be turned into any measurement I need. So even though our standard operating scheme starts out with all the qubits zero, and even though it ends with measurements in the standard basis, by inserting the right gates in between, I can do anything I want. Okay? Question? Okay, so that's sort of the general scheme. I'm going to have some zeros at the beginning, some gates in the middle, and the measurements and the standard basis at the end. That's my general scheme for doing quantum computing. Now, one thing I want to talk about is evaluating functions. And so, remember, let's talk about function evaluation. We talked about this for a classical reversible computer. You remember, we'd have a computation where we started out with an input and we had zero here, and we wound up with the input and the function evaluated at the input. And that was reversible. But the laws of reversible logic didn't just let me replace whatever was here by f of a. This only works for it being zero. In general, what we had is if this was a and this was b, then this is a and this is b plus f of a plus modulo 2. And this is reversible. For any f, any particular f. So what I want to do is I want to do something similar quantum mechanically. A might be n qubits. There might be a whole bunch of qubits involved in A. B is one qubit. So I want my function to take n bits of input and give me one bit of output. And so if I do that, how do I do it? Well, this looks like a C naught. But it's controlled not by the value of A, but by the value of F of A. And so quantum mechanically, what I have is the F-controlled knot. And it works like this. It's diagrammed like this. I have a bunch of inputs, and I evaluate F on those inputs. And the value of F controls whether I negate the output or not. Here are the inputs. The inputs. There may be a lot of them. Here's the output. Okay? And indeed, what happens is just the unitary version of above. I start out with A and B, and that maps to A and B F of A. And by the way, if I have a reversible function here, what this means is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between all the possible inputs and all the possible outputs. One-to-one correspondence. Here it means that this basis is a one-to-one correspondence between these guys and these guys. And they're, of course, all basis states in the computational basis. So this maps a basis to a basis, which is automatically unitary when I extend it. So I just thought I'd mention that in passing. Anyway, so this is how how we're going to choose to evaluate our functions. When we evaluate a function, we're going to have maybe lots of gates in here. This may be a really complicated thing. But I don't want to think about all the complications because I just want to think about what happens to what I mean by evaluating the function. This is what I mean by evaluating the function. I mean that I have a gate like this, which evaluates this function on the basis input, on the bits. This is a classical function, by the way. Based on the value of that function, it negates or doesn't negate the output. And it's all done unitarily. There's no measurement involved. So this is some big unitary which corresponds to that function. Yeah?
So if it's a unitary, then does that illustrate on the kind of function you
can? No. Just as this is reversible for any kind of function, okay? This is reversible for any kind of function, so this is unitary for any function. Okay? The fact that it's like this puts no such restrictions. Good question. All right. So what I want to do is I'm going to consider what's called an oracle problem. An oracle problem. Problem? Problem. I'm turning these things upside down somehow. Okay, it's an oracle problem. And what's an oracle problem? The idea is that I'm given a way of evaluating f. I'm given a way of evaluating f. In this case, in the quantum mechanical case, I can build this. But I don't know anything about the function f. What I simply know is that I can build something that evaluates that function. And that's my only access to the function. The only way that I can find the value of the function for a given input is by consulting the oracle. I can't I can't go any other way. I don't know anything else about the problem. This is, if you will, a subroutine of my computer program. And the only access I have to the function is by simply executing the subroutine. And the idea is to say that that's consulting the oracle. That's not what I want to say. And what I want to know is, I want to know some property of the function. You know, the property like, does the function ever give me a 1 as a result? The property of the function. All right? And my question is, how do I find out? And in particular, how many times do I have to consult the oracle? How many times do I have to evaluate f to answer my question? Okay? To answer the question, to determine the property. Because we don't have any other way to answer a question about f, the only access we have to the function is by evaluating it using the oracle. This is a special kind of computational problem. So for example, suppose my question is, does the function always give me 0? Does this function always give me 0? And to answer that question for sure, I'd have to evaluate that function on all of its inputs. Check every one of them. Because maybe the one I didn't check is the one that's not 0. Right? So in that case, the answer would be, I have to evaluate all the time. I have to evaluate it for all the inputs. So this is the kind of problem that we're going to consider. And here's our idea. Here's our quantum computing idea. The quantum computing idea. What we're going to do is we're going to actually evaluate F on all of its inputs at once. That is to say, we're going to evaluate F on a superposition of all of its inputs. On all of its inputs, because that's something that a quantum computer can do. It can do this. It could apply this gate to a superposition state. Classical computer can't. And then, to find the answer to my question, at the end of the day, I'm going to do an interference experiment. An interference experiment in a sort of a generalized way, a generalized interference experiment at the end. And that's going to allow me, that interference experiment, going to allow me to find answers that have contributions from all the different superpositions. I mean, all the different terms in the superposition. And therefore, I'll be able to answer my question. To do this, I need two pieces of technical machinery. The first one is very simple. The second one is also very simple, but not quite so simple. The first one is, I've got this F-controlled knot here. The first piece of machinery is something we might call F-controlled Z. And that would be like this. You've got F, and instead of having the knot down here, you have a Z. And what that is simply do the F-controlled knot that you did before, but put that knot between Hadamards. So let's find out what that does. Let's consider the input to be A, and this guy is, of course, 0. No, this guy could be 0 or 1. So what this would do, let's take this diagram and see what it does. A, 0, would map to A, I'll just tell you what the whole thing does. I'm a little short on time, so I'm just going to tell you what the whole thing does. You can work it out on your own. A0 maps to A0. A1 maps to A1, but maybe the phase changes. And when does the phase change? The phase changes if the value of F is 1. And if the value of F is 0, it doesn't change. Okay? So this has a phase change of 0 with respect to 1, conditional on the value of F of A. That's what this does. Okay? And why would we want to make up one of these things? Why isn't this? I mean, obviously, I can make one of these out of one of these, if this is true, and you can verify it for yourself. Why would I want to do it this way? Well, if I'm going to do an interference experiment, right, then what I want is I want a function to play with the phases. So I'll get constructive and destructive interference. And so this kind of evaluation is a little bit more convenient for that. And of course, I can build it out of the other kind of evaluation very easily. Okay, the second thing is about the Hadamard, n Hadamards, what we might call h to the n. We saw that if I applied h to the to n tensor products of that to a state consisting of all zeros, okay, then we got 1 over 2 to the n over 2 times the sum over all possible bit strings of the bit strings. We saw that the Hadamard allowed me to prepare a uniform superposition of all the inputs. And I want to be able to do that at the beginning of my thing, because I'm going to evaluate the function on all of its properties at once. But what happens if I apply this guy to some arbitrary basis? So I mean arbitrary basis state. A is equal to an n-bit string. What happens if I apply this to an arbitrary guy? What do I get? How do n Hadamard gates affect some arbitrary basis state of the n qubits? Well, it's going to introduce some. There we go. It's going to introduce some minus signs, and so let's see how that works. What I'm going to have, of course, is H acting on A1 tensor all the way up to H acting on A sub n, where these guys are the individual cube bit states, right? These are computational basis states. These A sub i's are either 0 or 1, because I'm assuming that I've got a computational basis state, right? That's what I've got. That's H tensor n acting on A. Well, let's see what's that. Okay, if this guy's a basis state, a 0, 1 state, then I'm going to either get plus or minus. Okay? 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1. And I'm going to get 0 minus 1 if this guy's 1. So I'll be able to write that as 0 plus a minus 1 to the A1 power times 1 tensor 0 plus a minus 1 to the AN power 1. And for every one of these guys, I'm going to get a factor of 1 over the square root of 2. And so that's going to come out at the beginning as 1 over 2 to the n over 2, where n is the number of bits. It's 1 over the square root of 2 to the n. OK? There's a frown. Is that OK? All right. So that's going to look something like this. First of all, I want to note that in this tensor product, every single combination of zeros and ones appear. Right? So this is going to be 1 over 2 to the n over 2 times the sum over all the possible bit combinations C of minus 1 to something. I don't know what that is. C. So let's figure out what that something is. Where do the minus 1's go? Some of them are going to have minus 1's and some of them are going to, it depends on whether there's an even number or odd number of signs here. Well, let's see. How many minus signs, minus 1 factors are in the C coefficient? Well, you're going to have a minus 1 factor. You're going to have a minus 1 factor only if C sub I is equal to 1 and A sub I is also equal to 1. So here, you're going to wind up with, for the first qubit, you're going to get a minus 1 to the A1 factor for the terms in which C1 is equal to 1. So in fact, the number of minus 1 factors is equal to A1 times C1, that's either a 1 or a 0, plus A2 times C2, all the way up to AN times CN. This is the number of minus 1 factors. We can conveniently write that as A dot C. A dot C is an integer, somewhere between 0 and N, and we get it by multiplying these and adding them up, but we add them up with regular arithmetic. It doesn't really matter if you take for my purposes, but yeah. And so that means that that coefficient isn't exactly A dot C, because that's the total number of minus signs for that coefficient. The total number of minus signs that appear for that coefficient. And I multiply those minus ones together. So if they're an even number of minus signs, of course, that's just a plus sign. Okay. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Now we know everything. that we need to know. All right. Now I want to state, yeah. Yeah, the C represents an n-bit string. And this, I'm adding up over all of them. They all appear here, but some of them appear with plus signs and some of them appear with minus signs. I'm trying to figure out which ones appear with plus signs and which ones appear with minus signs. And I find out that if I have, I'll get a minus one factor from this expansion for terms in which that particular C sub I is equal to 1 and the corresponding A sub I is equal to 1. For each such combination, I'll have a minus sign in this combination. And so the total number of minus signs is this. I raise minus 1 to that power, I'll get the net sign here. Okay, so now we're ready to state our problem. This is the Deutsch-Jose problem. Jose problem. Okay, the Deutsch-Jose problem. David Deutsch and Richard Jose. And we say, we know that our function f is either constant, that is to say it's always 0 or always 1, or balanced. That is to say we have equal numbers of zeros and ones. Oh, and f maps an n bit string n bits to 1 bit. Okay, and so there are 2 to the n of these guys, 2 to the n possible of these guys, and f is guaranteed. I know ahead of time that f is either a constant function, or it's a balanced function. Of course, there are many, many functions which are neither constant nor balanced. It just so happens that in this problem, I happen to know, for some reason not specified by the problem, that f is one of these guys. But I don't know which. And the question is, which? How many times must we evaluate f to be sure which? How many times must we evaluate f to be sure which one it is? So let's evaluate f once. You get 0. Let's evaluate f again. If you get 1, you're done. But suppose you get 0. And suppose you evaluate f again, and it's 0. And you evaluate f again, and it's 0. How many times would you have to go before you're sure it's constant and not balanced? Well, you have to take it on half of the inputs plus 1. If you evaluate it on half of the inputs, okay, if you evaluate it on half of the inputs, you might, by terrible mischance, have evaluated it on the half that were 0. And the next guy is going to be 1 for sure. So you have to evaluate it on half the inputs plus 1. And that's the classical answer. The classical answer is 1 half times 2 to the n plus 1. That's equal to 2 to the n minus 1 plus 1. And that might be huge. It's exponentially big in n. If this is a function on 30 bits, he'll be here all day. Or 100 bits, he'll be here for the lifetime of the sun. So this is a hard problem classically. Now, if you evaluate it random, if you can randomly evaluate it, okay, then you can be very confident after evaluating it only a few thousand times. Okay? Right? If you pick it random and you evaluate it a few thousand times, it's always 0. You say, yeah, this is a constant function. But that depends on being able to sample it at random. Suppose you had a pattern for how to evaluate it, and your worst enemy devised the function to fool you. Okay? All right? In that case, if your sampling isn't really random, then you could get the wrong answer. So we decide we have to be sure, even sampling probabilistically, you have to sample a lot to be sure. You have to sample this many to be sure, not just with high probability, but 100% probability, which one it is. Okay, so that's the key thing here. We have to be sure. And so this is a hard problem classically to be sure. What Deutsch and Josa showed was that you can solve this problem by evaluating the function far fewer times. Far fewer in this case means once. Okay? All right? So there's a huge difference between this number and one. All right? And that's the impressive difference that really got quantum computing theory started, because this is the first problem that was ever devised in which there was a massive difference between the power of a quantum computer and the power of a classical computer, which is one reason I'm introducing you to this one, because historically this got everybody excited. Okay, so here's how it works. Here's how it works. It's kind of a crazy idea. Let's draw the circuit. So I've got the inputs to my function, okay? And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to apply the Hadamard to all of those guys. So they start out being zero, but I'm going to use the Hadamard so that I get a uniform superposition of all of the possible inputs. Okay? And these are the inputs. The inputs. And then on the output bit, the output qubit, I'm going to apply x. And I'm going to turn this from 0 to 1. And the reason for that is easy to see, because I'm going to do my function evaluation using an F-controlled Z. I'm going to conditionally rotate the phase. But if this were 0, I'd never rotate the phase. So, okay, here we go. So now I have my function, evaluate it once on all the inputs, and I have an F-controlled Z. Okay, and at the end of the day, I'm going to do Hadamard again on all these guys. Okay, there it is. That's how you do it. Wasn't that simple? Well, let's analyze a little more carefully. By the way, this amounts to evaluating the function on a superposition of all the inputs, and this is the interference experiment. Okay? That's the interference experiment. Okay, so let's see how it works. We start out, of course, with our standard state. Zeros for all of these guys and zero for the output. I'll write it this way. And then when I apply the Hadamard, when I apply the Hadamard to all these guys and the x to this guy, I'll get the sum. Let's see. I'll get 1 over 2 to the n over 2. Times the sum over all the a's of a 1. So I got the sum over all the bit strings from the Hadamard, and I've got 1 here. And now I do. So I've got that one, that step. Now I do this step. I have 1 over 2 to the n over 2, sum over a. And now I'll flip the sign of this term, provided that the function value of A is 1. So this is minus 1 to the F of A 1. Okay? That's the state after this middle stage. Now I'm going to do the interference experiment. Let's do the interference experiment. That means I'm going to apply the Hadamard again to the A's. But I worked out how the Hadamard affects the A's. And so I can do that. So I'm going to have 1 over 2 to the n over 2 times the sum over A minus 1 to the f of a times, now I apply the Hadamards to all these guys. And that's going to be the sum over c of minus 1 to the a dot c, c, and there's a 1 in the final spot. Okay? All right. Now, I want to write the sum over the c's of the outside. Oh, sorry, I missed something, didn't I? You see what I missed? There's another 1 over 2 to the n, isn't there? 1 over 2 to the n over 2. Sum over c minus 1 to the a dot c, c1. Okay. The 1's just along for the ride. Actually, this thing never changes its value. Isn't that weird? Okay, so, but the relative phases of them change. So let's see. What's that equal to? Well, the 1 over 2 to the 1 over 2 to the n over 2 factor is combined to a 1 over 2 to the n factor. And I'm going to sum over c of a coefficient times c1. Okay? And what's this coefficient? Well, it's going to be the sum over a of minus 1 to the a dot c plus f of a. Right? Make sure I've got enough room here. A dot c plus f of a. All right, that's my final state. And these guys will tell me the likelihood that I'll, that if I make a measurement on the c's, I'll get various results. So now, here's what I want to do. I want to measure the input qubits. And I want to ask the question, I'm going to do my measurements on these guys. Okay? I'm going to do my measurements on the input qubits. I don't care about the output qubit. The output qubit's still 1. I want to measure the input qubits, and I wanted to ask, what's the probability that I get all zeros? What's the probability that I get all zeros? I make a measurement. I'll get, you know, a bit of information for each one of these guys. What's the probability that they're all zeros? Well, this tells me that this is, this expansion tells me that that's going to be 1 over 2 to the n, sum over a. The c I'm considering is 0, so this is just going to be minus 1 to the f of a, all squared. Okay? That's going to be the probability that my measurement result gives me 0. Now, there are two things that might be true. The function might be constant. So suppose f is constant. Well, in that case, all of these guys are the same. They're either all 0 or all 1, right? So when I add them all up, I'll either be adding up 2 to the n 1s or 2 to the n minus 1s. So that means that the probability of getting this is 1 over 2 to the n sum over a of either plus or minus 1. There's one particular one, which is going to be plus or minus 1 squared, which is 1. I'm sure, I'm 100% sure to get all zeros. If the function, the f constant, that means the probability of getting all zeros is 1. 100% of the time will I get zeros for all of these guys. But suppose the function's balanced. Okay, suppose suppose f is balanced. There are just exactly as many zeros as ones in the output. The probability of 0 to the n there is going to be 1 over 2 to the n sum over a minus 1 to the f of a magnitude squared. Oh, but let's take a look. If this is balanced, that means there'll be exactly as many terms here with plus 1 as with minus 1. So what does that tell me about this amplitude? It's 0. So that means f balanced implies that the probability that you get all 1s is equal to 0. So if I make this measurement, I can ask myself, are the measurement results all equal to 0? If the answer is yes, the function is constant. If the answer is no, the function is balanced. A single evaluation of the function. Okay. That's exponentially less effort. There's lots of things to notice here. There's some weird stuff. For example, the final answer to my question is in the input qubits, not the output qubits. Do you find that a little weird? Remember the theorem we proved at the beginning of the class, though. That this function evaluation is not one-way information flow. This function evaluation, information flows both ways. And the information that I'm interested in winds up being being in the input. As I said, a classical computer that samples f really, really randomly can give an answer with a fair degree of confidence in many fewer evaluations than 2 to the n over 2, or 2 to the n minus 1. But to be sure, that requires this exponentially large amount of function evaluation. Yeah. Why we need the output qubits? Because of the way I'm evaluating the function, I don't actually ever change the basis state of the output. What I change is the relative phases of the different elements of the superposition. Okay? The relative phases. So measuring the output won't tell me anything because the basis state doesn't change. And I've fed in a basis state. So that's why what we are interested in is not there. Why do we look at the inputs? Well, this relative phase is, since this is a particular basis state, the relative phase is really, if you look here, those relative phases are really relative phases among different terms of the superposition of the C states. We can write this as 1 over 2 to the n over 2 times sum over a minus 1 to the f of a. That's where all the information about f is. A tensor 1. And you can see from this that information about the function, the thing that has been affected by the function, has been the relative phases of the superposition of the output qubits. Like so. No, sorry, the input. I'm sorry. Yes, I mean the input qubits. Yes. So why do you need the output qubit? Oh, well, because... Why do you need the output qubit? Oh, well, what we've essentially done is imagined a unitary operator. The net effect of this is to imagine a unitary operator which changes the phase of your state depending on the value of the function f. Okay? That's what this does. So I've simply told you how to take since I know how to build this out of one of these F-controlled knots, which is a sort of a more ordinary kind of function evaluation, I've taken, what I've basically done is I've taken that kind of function evaluation and turned it into one of these function evaluations which just, where the function just affects the phase of your state. And so if you want to think about this, this is kind of a work qubit. A work qubit that allows me to take that basic kind of function evaluation and turn it into this. It's kind of interesting that it never becomes entangled with anything. But on the other hand, I don't know exactly. I've written this as sort of a black box. Along the way to doing this, lots of things might have happened to the output. Okay.
So the idea is that you're just giving a function that has an output. So
that's right. All I have is this black box. All I can do is apply this black box. How can I apply the black box? Because that's the key idea of an oracle problem. The function is a black box. I can apply it or not. Yeah?
Can essentially all really difficult classical complexity problems be transformed into essentially trivial ones?
No. By no means. No. In fact, the class of problems that can be done better is a small class. I mean, we know many such problems, but in the class of among all problems, it seems to be a very small class. We're not sure of that, actually. We can't prove that. But we think that's true. There's a very special structure about this problem that we've exploited. And this problem is not a very natural one, but there are a few natural problems, like factoring integers, which can also take advantage of, which have a structure which the quantum superposition principle can take advantage of. This special problem is exactly designed to give this this nice distinction. Yeah.
At least
what?
A quantum computer is. You said that not all problems are faster than quantum computers, but at least it measures the speed of the classical computer.
Well, the speed in this case is counting the number of times it evaluates a function, okay? And so if I wanted to talk about actual speed,
no.
How many?
No.
Yeah, the number of times it evaluates the function. It's certainly the case that any classical computation I could do on a quantum computer that just takes basis states to basis states. I can turn any classical computation into a quantum computation that wouldn't be very interesting because it's just a superposition of things. Here, this is where the really the quantum magic goes. I can evaluate it on superpositions. I can interfere the results. That's kind of okay. Yeah. Yes. And that path integral way of thinking about it is right here. This quantity, here, well, let's see. Right. The path integral formulation is right here. I imagine a zero computational initial state, and I imagine a zero computational final state, and I look at the I look at how I can get from here to here by means of intermediate states here and here. So here I've got zeros, and here I've got zero, but here I've got A, and here I've got C. And so a computational path would be going from zero to A to C to zero for all different kinds of A's and C's. And the amplitude for doing that just exactly, as I can see from here, it's just exactly 1 over 2 to the n sum over a minus 1 to the f of a. Okay, the amplitude for each path. Okay? Turns out it's independent of c for 0 at the end. If I go to some particular endpoint, then I'll have to do something else. Okay, For the balanced functions, when I do this sum over all the possible intermediate computational states, I get zero. And when I do the constant functions, the sum over all the possible intermediate states, they all constructively interfere. So you can think of these things as representing intermediate states. So I don't know if that's useful, but that's a way of thinking about it. We're way over time. I'm terribly sorry. I promise to go short tomorrow.